Portland, Maine. I don't know where that is. Leave your bags in the car, keep it running. I won't pretend that I won't miss this. But Portland, Maine, I don't know where that is. And I don't wanna know. I don't wanna know.
Welcome back. Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. Tim McGraw may not know where Portland, Maine is, but we do. Here at Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB 1310. And my first guest certainly does. Please join me in welcoming John Jennings, who is the Portland City Manager. Welcome, John.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
Great. You ever been introduced with the Portland, Maine song?
No. And actually, I think this may be the first time I've actually been introduced as the Portland City Manager.
Really?
As well.
Yeah. So we have a media first. We'll have to rev up the media machine there, Deb.
This is huge.
Yeah.
Big, big deal.
It is it's so great to have you. I should point out that you and I have known each other for many years, I think since you first came to Portland.
Yes, I remember having our first meeting on Commercial Street to talk about the Red Claws.
Right. And you were really the catalyst for introducing the Red Claws and the D-League here in Maine. Since then, you've gone on and moved into a number of both private and civic roles. Red Mango, love it, at the mall. You're one of the owners down there, I think.
Yep.
You also got involved with local politics in Cumberland, filled an empty seat there, and then you went down to South Portland, straightened everything out there, and now you're the city manager in Portland.
Yeah, and it's all done in Portland now. I've been there 2.5 months, and we're fine. Everything's straightened out. So,
well, fantastic.
Yeah.
Hey, before we start talking about what's going on in the city, a couple things I want to talk about. Yeah, you and I have talked about it for years, but I think it's just fascinating, your background and how you first got involved with politics. You know, you've had an interesting background both in sports and politics. You spent some time in the White House, which I think is fascinating. I want to talk about that. And just as before we get on the air, we were talking about the Pope's visit, and you mentioned that not only while you were serving in the White House that you met, was it Pope John Paul?
Yes, John Paul II.
John Paul II, but you were down a few days ago down in D.C., and saw the current Pope and his fiat drone by. So why don't we start with just your background in government and politics, and then let's talk about all of your Pope experience.
Okay, we definitely could talk about the papal experience.
Yeah, so in terms of background, how did you first get involved, your interest, and how did that lead, and what was your role in the White House during the Clinton administration?
Is that right? During Clinton. I've had a lifelong passion for public policy, history, particularly presidential history. And so when I was 5 years of age, I had memorized all the presidents, and I was like the family freak show. They would bring me out when we had guests, and I would recite all the presidents, and then I would run off to bed. and so I've had this lifelong passion for presidential history. But I had I went to Indiana University undergrad, and I had intended to go there to go to law school, really, and run for office someday or be a judge. And my life took a completely different turn after I met a mild-mannered gentleman by the name of Bob Knight, who I became a student manager for the IU basketball team, which led to my career in the NBA. I was, of course, with the Celtics for several years.
He never threw a chair at you, did he?
Oh, he threw plenty of things.
He threw plenty of things. And, one of the legendary coaches, both for his success on the court and for his temper on the court and –
yeah.
Interesting character.
And his loyalty. I mean, he is one of those guys that if you kind of went through the fire with him, he was like Red Auerbach in that way. Very, very loyal to people who were loyal to him. And really, he gave me the greatest opportunity to get involved in basketball, which led to my 2 years with the Pacers and then, of course, my 11 years with the Celtics. But I always, Jack McCallum, who used to write for Sports Illustrated, wrote a book about the Celtics back in the early 90s, and he described me as the bookish assistant coach who could be seen reading the New York Times in the locker room. And as you know, because your background in sports, not many people read the New York Times in a NBA locker room. So I've always had this passion for public service and public policy. And so when Rick Pitino put an end to my career with the Celtics back in 1997, I had been going to Harvard for my master's degree at the Kennedy School. And one of my professors had suggested I apply for something called the White House Fellowship. And I applied, not recognizing how difficult that was to achieve. But fortunately, I was very, very lucky to have been selected and spent a year as a fellow at the White House. I worked in the Office of Cabinet Affairs for a great friend of mine, Thurgood Marshall Jr. Goody was the head of the Office of Cabinet Affairs, and we handled a lot of diverse issues, which was fascinating. When I was also with the Celtics, Lenny Zakim, who was the head of the Anti-Defamation League in the greater Boston area, and I were best friends, and we had created a foundation called Team Harmony, which brought together thousands of young people to take a stand against hate and bigotry. Mrs. Clinton actually wrote about it in her book, It Takes a Village. So I knew Hillary before I got to the White House. When I got there, of course, the president was fascinated with my basketball background and kind of developed a relationship there, went to a few games with him. And so, and then my fellowship year ended and they asked me to stay. And so I was able to stay 3.5 years, both at the White House and the Justice Department in Washington. And it was truly one of the greatest times.
And, we originally talked about the Pope John Paul II. And in your role at the White House, you had some interesting experiences, both in terms of visiting the Oval Office. I think we've talked about you being on Air Force One, which me is kind of this aspirational thing. Air Force One just seems just this iconic, unbelievably cool thing. I'd love to at some point have the opportunity to travel on Air Force One. But how did you come about to be in the room or to have an audience with or be connected with Pope John Paul II years ago.
Well, part of the relationships I had in Boston, of course, I'm Catholic and had known many of the cardinal at the time and many of the leadership of the Catholic Church in the Archdiocese in Boston. Lenny, as I mentioned earlier, Lenny Zakim was my best friend and he was the head of the ADL. The cardinal at the time and Lenny created a trip to Rome and Israel. We spent 10 days, so it was a combined group of 25 Jews and 25 Catholics. And we went to Israel and explored the country together, and we shared our heritage. And then on the way back, we stopped in Rome to speak with the Holy Father, because he was about to go to Israel shortly thereafter our trip and speak with the Holy Father about our shared experiences. So the first time I got a chance to meet John Paul was in Rome.
At the Vatican.
And then the following year, I was invited by the cardinal to go back to Rome for the Pope's 80th birthday. And so I went to a large birthday celebration for him and, again, got to see him. So was very honored. There are two people in my life that I've met that I can honestly say that I was in the absolute presence of grace, and that was Nelson Mandela and John Paul. And it's just the, you had alluded to the fact that I saw Pope Francis. I did see him on Tuesday.
Yeah, earlier this week.
At the White House, and the Fiat did drive right by me. So, again, kind of the state of grace, this peacefulness. I've never had a chance to meet the Dalai Lama, but I understand that you have a similar feeling when you meet him, so.
Fascinating background. We have John Jennings here in the studio. He is the recently named, appointed, voted on Portland City Manager. John, why don't we talk about that for people that may not be familiar with city government, particularly in Portland, relative to how your role is different than the mayor, which is an elected role, and we have an election coming up in November. There's also a city council. And talk a little bit about your role as Portland City Manager versus the mayor versus the council itself.
The way the charter is written in Portland, the new charter, I should say, you do have the elected mayor who has a lot of responsibility around the council, council direction, agendas, and so forth. As city manager, I'm really the CEO of the city. All the departments report to me. The council or the mayor has no authority over individual staff people. They really only are responsible for three people, the corporation council, the city clerk, and the city manager. They can hire and fire those three positions, but the city manager really is responsible for everyone else.
When you say everyone, public works, public safety, fire, police?
Exactly.
Police chief reports to?
The jet port. Yeah, police chief reports to me. The fire chief reports to me. The jet port. We have a lot of things that we own and operate and manage. So it's the way I look at it is we have about a $222 million budget. So it's a quarter of a billion dollar company that I'm running, but in a very public atmosphere. As you know, having been very public in your career, the media is very focused on government, and as they should be. So we operate in not like the private sector where we can do a lot of things confidentially and so forth. We always are subject to FOIA and many other engagements that we have with citizens and residents and business owners.
So talk a little bit about, in terms of day-to-day understanding the structure of the city manager. First of all, there was some sort of selection process a few months ago. There were a number of candidates, and then that was something the city council voted on, and it's an annual salaried position. And then you have both the direct staff in City Hall, and then all the other departments report to you. But, you know, I don't know if it was 3 or 4 years ago, or I should know, but for years, Portland didn't have a mayor, and it was more of a ceremonial position. Maybe there was a ceremonial title, but a member of the council was designated for ceremonial purposes, but it was considered a weak mayor in political terms. And then I think Mike Brennan was the first publicly elected mayor. He's up for re-election. Ethan Strimling, I think, has announced he's interested in running. Mike's, and I think there's some other folks running. How has that, from your experience, and you've just started as city manager, how is the role of mayor in Portland positioned? If you're the CEO and you have the fiduciary responsibility for the contracts and for the people and the $222 million. The council is the voting authority in terms of setting ordinances and, in effect, city law. What actual power and effect does the mayor have, and where does that overlap with your job, and where does that overlap with the city council?
Well, to kind of put it in, again, in business terms, I look at the mayor as the chairman of the board, and of course the council is the board of directors. But they're the policy-making authority. They set policy for the city, the council, and the mayor. And the mayor has a lot of responsibility in terms of setting agendas, appointing people to committees and boards, really kind of bringing people together, bringing the council together around issues. For instance, when he ran the first time, he talked a lot about the minimum wage. Of course, the city of Portland just passed the $10.10 minimum wage a few weeks ago. That was a big issue for the mayor and his campaign. So he does have the unique ability to set the agenda. Now, I, of course, work with him a lot on the agenda and have had a very good working relationship with Mayor Brennan. It's really kind of that framework, though. But, you know, the mayor can't order staff to do anything. He can certainly talk to me about priorities and so forth. But the other eight council members also have the same kind of relationship with me, as well as the corporation council and the city clerk. So it's not like a Boston mayor, where Mayor Menino was a very, very strong mayor. Everything kind of ran through him. Everyone reported to the mayor. This is a very different concept.
Interesting. We have John Jennings here as the Portland city manager. You brought up minimum wage. That was a interesting and kind of controversial issue here in Portland. It's also a big issue nationally, wage disparity, inequality, all that's kind of a big deal. There were a few bumps in the road, I think, when Portland passed the minimum wage, tipped workers and exemption for tips. What is the status of the minimum wage being passed? Is it in effect now? And what's your thoughts in terms of 10-10? Some people have proposed $15. There are some proposals, should the state weigh in and have a minimum wage? Traditionally, there's been a national minimum wage. In recent history, it feels like many municipalities have kind of jumped in, famously, I think, Seattle. So what's your thought on minimum wage, since it has a real impact on fiscal decisions in the city? It has impact on businesses to pay into taxes. And what's your thought on the 10-10 minimum wage?
The council, as I mentioned, council a few weeks ago passed the 10-10 minimum wage. It goes into effect January 1st of next year. And so we have some time. We have, of course, the posters and everything else that we have to put together, but to get ready for the implementation of 10-10. I actually, as you know, you had mentioned Red Mango, so I'm a small business owner in addition, and have had to meet payrolls on many occasions. I actually have been supportive of the 10-10 minimum wage, and it's unfortunate the way this kind of was rolled out, because this is a really positive thing that the city did. The controversy around tipped workers, it's unfortunate the way that it was developed, because everyone got an increase. Even though they kept the $375 for tipped workers as the base wage, if a tipped worker doesn't make in tips the difference between $375 and $1010, the employer is still responsible for that. So their minimum wage, tipped workers and everyone else, will be $1010 in the city of Portland. Philosophically, it is one of those things where this would be much better left to the state, for instance, to increase the minimum wage, as opposed to a lot of different cities or towns increasing their individual minimum wage. But we simply don't have that avenue, and I applaud the council for kind of moving forward in that direction. As also taking my hat off as city manager and putting my hat on as a small business owner, I have great concerns about the $15 minimum wage. That would be if South Portland, which is where my frozen yogurt place is located, if South Portland, for instance, went to a $15 minimum wage, I more than likely would have to close the doors because I would not be able to stay open. Because when you think about this, it's the minimum wage is – doesn't include – you can't pay your managers the minimum wage, because managers, of course, expect to be paid.
So everything has to be scaled up.
Everything goes up. And so if you're starting at $15, then your managers are going to be expecting to be paid $20 plus an hour. And so that would be impossible for us to handle with our small, tiny business. But of course, that'll be up to the voters of Portland to decide whether $15 is the avenue to go.
Is that on November's referendum for both Portland, or is South Portland considering something separate?
Just Portland at this point. The Green Party has brought forward a voter referendum to decide on the $15 minimum wage in Portland exclusively. Of course, other communities are waiting to see what we do, and I would assume that other communities will adopt the 10-10 if at some point.
Is that something the city council can override? You know, I'm all for public referendums, but there are some elements that involve governance that I'm not sure if the public referendum is the right mechanism. You know, if you ask the public through a referendum if they want to see taxes lowered by 20%, you'd probably have an overwhelming majority saying, yeah, that sounds great. Because when you're voting on something in a very kind of singular, myopic way, like should we raise minimum wage to $15, should we lower taxes, it's easy, I think, for the electorate to vote impulsively, maybe without the context or the real understanding of the impact. So what's your thought on just the referendum process on the $15 minimum wage?
Well, to answer your question, if this does pass in November – and implemented, and it will be graduated. So it's not, I don't want to give anyone the impression that it becomes $15 on January 1st. It's a graduated increase up to $15. But there is a five-year limitation of any type of amendment or changes. So once that, if that were to pass in November, the council cannot do anything for 5 years. And so we would have a graduated minimum wage in Portland at the $15, the Green Party proposal for 5 years that cannot be changed.
Interesting. We have John Jennings. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. John is the Portland City Manager. Let's talk about Portland relative to Portland's role within the broader economy here in Maine. Obviously, both Portland as a city and what's known as Portland Metro is the economic gateway for Maine. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but I think, you know, it's the strongest economic engine in the state. I had Mayor Brennan here a couple of years ago, and we were talking about the impact of him not having a close relationship with our governor. And I had assumed that Mayor Brennan would have had, like, you know, the equivalent of the bat phone on his desk and be able to pick up the phone and reach Augusta and talk to the governor. And what he said just really shocked me. He was like, we have no real relationship with the governor. In many ways, Portland is just autonomous other than just, you know, legislative mechanisms in Augusta. But the governor has no real relationship with Portland. But how do you see Portland's role within the overall state? You know, do you have any interface in Augusta? And as the city manager representing a budget of about $250 million, what type of interface do you have in Augusta, and what type of overlap between state, county, and city government exists relative to Portland?
The our relationship, or I should say my relationship in Augusta, really is more at the commissioner level. I have certainly met the governor in the past, but just in the last few weeks, I've spoken with David Bernhardt, the commissioner of transportation, who is just a really terrific, terrific person who does a great job, I think, for the state. George Gervais, who is the commissioner for the Department of Economic and Community Development, again, a person who really works hard. So at a commissioner level, I certainly have those relationships and have worked with both of those individuals in the past. And I think we have a very good working relationship as a city. The city of Portland, though, is the vital center of the state. And I would disagree with anyone who did not think that was the case.
Well, in terms of economics, in terms of culture, in terms of education, in terms of proximity, in terms of the rest of New England, Portland is the gateway. Right?
Absolutely. And we are the gateway, and we are that mechanism. And it's certainly not to disparage any other part of the state, but that is who we are. And we have, I think, a unique responsibility to move things forward on a policy side of things that maybe the governor doesn't agree with or Augusta doesn't agree with. But certainly there's a passionate citizenry in Portland who believes in sustainability and other things that really matter in the end of it. So I think we have at least in my view, we have a good working relationship with the administration, whether the mayor and the governor speak or not.
What other issues exist right now in the docket? Obviously, there's council meetings throughout the month. There's voting meetings, workshops, operations meetings. You interface with all the departments in terms of, as we said before, with the exception of education, right? So the school system reports up through the school board, and that's the second elected body relative to the city government. But what other issues are kind of percolating here in Portland? I know there's a lot of discussion having to do with affordable housing. There's a lot of policy discussion on. There's a number of developments that are pending. For years, Portland was seen as being very restrictive and possibly not very welcoming for some economic development, particularly in the waterfront. So what issues exist now that you're working on in your office, and specifically in terms of affordable housing, where do you see that as a policy, either mandate by the people or something the council is looking at and you're looking at?
Well, what I love about this job, it reminds me a lot of when I was at the White House. Every hour it was a different set of circumstances, a different set of issues. I go in there in the morning and I know my meeting schedule, but I have no idea what's going to be coming my way, which is really what kind of gets me up in the morning and why I love this job so much. The way I've approached this is it's really an internal and external set of circumstances. Internally, we've had a workforce that has had some morale issues. We have an organization, if you will, that needs to be reprioritized. We need to look at the way municipal government does things. I'm of the belief, and my mantra has been, let's get back to the basics, what city government should be doing. We should be paving. We should be looking at different ways to collect our solid waste. we have an antiquated system in Portland of collecting solid waste. It's the old style of a guy on the back of a truck throwing cans of trash in with trash blowing all over the community, as opposed to the cart system and an automated way of doing things. So we're going to be bringing that to the council here in the fall of a completely different way of looking at that. And that's some of the changes that we need to make internally. Externally, as you mentioned, there's a lot of development. There's another referendum on the ballot this year about views, the view corridors and so forth, specific to the 4th Street property, the Portland company. So that's a big issue that will be coming to the voters this fall. There's a group of people in the city that would like to see a complete ban on pesticides, something that I am working on with Councillor Marshall, David Marshall, who's a councillor, and his committee. There's one of the big issues that actually we're going to be talking about on Monday in workshop is general assistance as it relates to the asylum seekers population in the greater Portland area. You know, the governor failed to veto Public Law 324, which actually gives any municipality opportunity to be reimbursed at 70% to provide general assistance to people who are seeking asylum, who are lawfully present and seeking asylum. But it's all in the rulemaking, right? So we're kind of still waiting for DHHS to come through with their rules and really so we can make sure that our city ordinance adheres to that. And then there's inclusionary zoning, which Councillor Kevin Donahue is going to be bringing forward to the council this actually very soon. And that is really about the affordable housing side of things, where 10% any residential project over 10 units, there will be a requirement of 10% of the units being affordable. And so that'll be coming to the council to be discussed and voted upon. That's what's so great about this job. There's so many things that we can talk about.
Where are you guys on the pot issue? I know there was a voter referendum, and is that just take place as law? I mean,
it's passed law. It's law in Portland.
So within Portland city limits, and in your role as city manager with the chief of police, Suszczyk. We're a really nice guy. He was in here a few months ago. Great experience as a police officer. He also stepped in briefly to help with city government, right, when there was a transition.
I tell you, the city of Portland is so incredibly fortunate to have him as the police chief. I mean, he is phenomenal at what he does.
So that's taken effect. How are you enjoying the job with your transitions recently from sports to serving on a local municipal government in Cumberland and then working as an assistant city manager in South Portland? How are you enjoying the job of being a city manager in Portland?
Well, I mean, you know me. I mean, I'm much more of an entrepreneurial type. And this is, to me, is one of the ultimate opportunities to be entrepreneurial in municipal government. I look at everything that we do. And when I met with the council during my interview process, I literally begged them not to pick me if they wanted the status quo. But if they wanted someone who was going to come in, look at the way we do everything and propose new ways of getting things done. And then, of course, I also mentioned to them that they needed to go through the city manager. And if they envisioned a strong city manager, I certainly would be interested. And so fortunately for me, and they chose me a little over 3 months ago. And that's literally the kind of the way I've been approaching this, is everything's on the table, both internally and externally. You love this. You love this stuff as well. I mean, this, I think you'd love every minute of what I get to do, because it's really reshaping the future of municipal government. The thing, though, Steve, is I think I'm most blessed with, though, is an incredible workforce in Portland. We have over 1,300 people who are unbelievably dedicated to the city.
Well, good luck with that. We're running out of time, but I really appreciate you coming in, and I do think that it's an exciting time here in the state, and I do think that Portland is the epicenter and the gateway for many of the great opportunities and successes in the state, and you're certainly playing a key role now. So I wish you nothing but best of luck going forward.
And certainly thank you for the opportunity, and if we could ever attract you into Portland, you'll let me know.
I will talk to the Falmouth City Council, which I have a wonderful relationship with every once in a while. And
now we want you to stay in Falmouth, but
we'll
anything
stay in
new,
Falmouth. Anything new. Perfect. Yes. Very political way to put that.
Exactly.
Well, thanks for being here, John.
Thank you.
And it was John Jennings. He is the Portland City Manager. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with Fred Forsley, who is the founder and CEO of Shipyard Brewery.
Stay tuned for more of Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts. StopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
That justice is the one thing you should always find. You gotta saddle up your boys, you gotta draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
Nothing like beer for your horses. That would be a waste of good shipyard beer.
Yeah, unless you really loved your horse, I guess.
Well, yeah, a lot of people do. Please join me in welcoming our guest, Fred Forsley. He's president and co-founder of Shipyard Brewing. Hey, this is the busy time of year for you guys, right?
Yeah, we actually had the busiest July in sales, beer sales, than we've ever had. We broke a record, so it was big.
Well, I want to talk about what's going on at Shipyard. I want to talk about what's going on in beer. And you've been here a couple of times, and it's always interesting to kind of review how you first got into the beer business, because it feels like everyone in the world is starting a beer company. There's microbrews, and you guys were, I think, the first iconic local brand, and then a lot of microbrews happen, and you guys keep chugging along. But how did you first get involved with Shipyard again in the beer business?
Yeah, it was actually by meeting Alan Pugsley. I had was in the real estate business, and I was looking to rent a space in Kennebunkport on the harbor where Federal Jack's is now. But I met Richard Pfeffer from Gritty's and Ed Stebbins, and then they introduced me to Alan Pugsley. And next thing you know, I'm in the beer business 23 years later.
Wow. And it had to be a whole different landscape back then, right? It was very unusual for, like, microbrews, local brews.
I mean, there was Gritty's, there was Gary's, there was a few people that had started and failed, but for the most part, I think we were like the third or fourth player that was real, doing it. There were a lot of home brewers at the time, so that was really Maine was a pretty strong home brewing community.
Yeah, it feels like even today there's blogs, there's Twitter people, and everyone claims to be a beer expert, whether it's homebrew or microbrew.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is there are more and more women getting into the beer business, and there's always used to be a saying, God loves a woman that gives birth to a brewer, and now it goes to a variety of levels there. So, but
I've never heard that saying. Sully, have you heard that saying?
Not once in my life.
Do you like beer,
Sully? I do.
Well, let's talk about that. How many beers, the core beers, and you have seasonal beers, and you've got Pumpkinhead coming out. But how many core beers do you have? Obviously it's about shelf space, and in the restaurant business, there's only so many taps. So how do you decide when to add a new beer, and what's the current lineup?
Yeah, it's a challenge. We have Shipyard Export, which is our flagship, but we basically at Shipyard, we have Shipyard Export, and then Monkey Fist IPA has become our new flagship. And in a lot of markets, we lead with it because IPAs are so desired. So the Monkey Fist IPA and then our seasonal. So those three at Shipyard, and then Sea Dog, which we are a sister brewery, we lead with, believe it or not, the blueberry, because it's one of the leading blueberry beers in the country. And then we came up with a grapefruit peach beer, Sunfish, which we're also, and then we do a hazelnut porter, which people love a lot. So we're really running two separate brands. And then, uniquely enough, we have Old Thumper with our Marston's relationship from England. So we're flying a lot of flags. So, you almost lose fingers when you start going down the list. But then I could go on to We are looking at doing a session beer to add to that category and add to that. And we added a second seasonal where we have the head series. We do pumpkin head, gingerbread head. We're coming out with orange head. And then we go into melon head. And so there's like five of the head series. And then we added alongside of that a separate series of seasonals. Like
what?
We came out with Little Hop of Horrors this Halloween. And then we're going to do our winter beer. And then we're going to do a red IPA. So it never, Stevie, would I tell you,
wow,
you stay up at night thinking and dreaming or drinking, coming up with more beers. That's what happens.
Yeah, you probably need to have a beer to think up more beers.
Yes, that's the only way we do it.
What is the seasonality kind of makeup of new beers? And I enjoy a good beer anytime. And, you know, even though Pumpkinhead is obviously tied into Halloween, and there are some, are lighter beers traditionally warm weather beers and are heavier beers, or is that just all promotion hype?
Yeah, no, I think people like lighter beers in the summertime. But what's strange is that, you know, in Florida right now, IPAs are huge, and nobody in the beer business 20 years ago or 15 years ago ever thought darker, heavier beers would work in warmer climates. So we're up with Monkey Fist IPA, which is a heavy IPA, high octane, like over 7%, and people are drinking a lot of it in the summer. So I think what people drink at what time of year is changing dramatically because of all the interest in beer.
I hadn't even thought of the alcohol content, but how big of a role does that play? Like you mentioned, 7%. What's the highest
percent, and then
what's the lowest in terms of beer?
People are doing barley wines that are up over 12, 13%, even higher, which is crazy, right? Old Thumper used to be a high alcohol beer at just under 7%, and now Prelude was the original strong beer, which was pushing 8%. Now that is not seen as big a beer. You know, and then now the session beers are getting under 3% or right around 3%. So, but they're doing it with a hop taste or, you know, some little more complexity. We're actually thinking of coming back out with our light beer because you're finding that people want a fuller flavored light that can be classified as a light. So, I mean, what's interesting is that people are trying, I don't want to say everything you come out with, but they're willing to experiment a lot more. That was the biggest difference 20 years ago. To get somebody just to even try an export was a challenge, right?
Right.
No, I don't like those
somebody
beers.
Either liked Budweiser, yep, they liked your beer, Miller Lite, and they were just, that was their beer.
Bass and Guinness. If they drank Bass and Guinness, you had a better shot at getting them to try it. Now,
the whole category is open to people almost making it like an ice cream thing where you don't want the same flavor all the time.
Yeah, which is a real challenge for brewers because, you know, there are a lot of people that are setting up these, you know, just one-offs all the time. It's tough to create a brand that way, something that's going to be there 10 years from now.
Well, talk about the industry from when you first got into it 20-something years ago to now, where, you know, you and I have talked about this in the past, where years ago I worked with Miller Brewing Company and their sports group, and ironically, at one point, Shipyard, you ended up partnering with Miller, and Miller ended up buying you, and then you bought them back. But what's the big difference now in the beer business, now that they're all consolidated between Anheuser-Busch and SAB and Miller, versus what you're doing at Shipyard in terms of both the product, the distribution, and the future?
Yeah, and I think because they're owned by foreign entities, you know, Bud is a Belgian, and the Miller Coors Group has its South Africans. Those have truly become removed from the American beer culture in the sense. One thing, though, they definitely have leveraged marketing dollars to keep and maintain their relationships. Originally, I thought they'd steer away from that, but the big guys are still, you know, keeping their strong relationships either with certain rock bands or certain programming. You know, you have Landshark, which is really a Budweiser product, you know, teaming up with Kenny Chesney and or Corona.
Right.
And those things are smart for the big guys. I think you're seeing now kind of two levels. The lower local craft, that's almost like a brew pub, but they don't have a restaurant, is focusing on selling a few kegs locally, so they're affecting on premise. And then there are regional brewers that are somewhat regional and also trying to be national or go national. That's kind of where we fall. And I would say brands like Long Trail, fat New Belgians, probably big, they're much bigger than us, but they're in Denver starting for, well, from Colorado, that are really regional brewers that are spotty in their growth in areas where they can grow. So they're really like three and four different segments. Then there's the whole brew pub business, which is really a restaurant concept. Those are growing in a lot of parts of the country too. So it's made the business a lot more complex. You know, almost 35 years ago, there was probably 70 brewers in the country. Today, there's over 4,000 brewery licenses and growing, a brewery every day almost.
Well, pretty soon, everyone will have their own brewery.
Exactly.
We have Fred Forsley here in the studio. Fred is the president and co-founder of Shipyard Brewing, Maine's very own, and now they've expanded way beyond Maine. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. When I grew up, which was during the Eisenhower administration, Coors wasn't sold east of the Mississippi. So there was this mythology of if somebody went to Colorado and they had those funky cans where you kind of had the push button, you know, a little button to release the air, a big button to drink. And then with AB, it's about the Clydesdales and it's about Americana. Miller Lite had huge campaigns in the 70s and 80s about All-Stars. But I don't know if we see as much of that now. I think a lot of it is just about the brands and the packaging gets bigger and kind of the mythology has dropped off a little bit. Does that sound right to you? Or
yeah, especially, well, in the big brands, definitely. But in the smaller brands, experiential marketing, I kind of call it, where people will visit the brewery and get close to the brewery and get close to the brewers. We have a trade brewer, Bruce Elam, that'll set up brew tours where if you want 20 people to go on a brew tour, he'll spend, you know, 2 hours really getting you close to the beer, answering every question, taking you through the brewery. And that is happening all over the country where smaller and regional craft brewers are spending more energy getting closer to the people that make and brew the beers. We're doing a lot of that in all our locations at Federal Jackson, Kennebunkport. We're doing brewery tours. So people want
to... What about the main brewery, the big brewery in Portland?
Yeah,
do
we do that.
Tours?
Yeah, we do
so
every
if,
day.
If so. People go to shipyard.com, they can find out information or send a note. And
exactly.
Can they just sit there and just keep sampling beers, or do you end up kicking them out and saying, hey, you got to get out of here. You can't just sample 10.
After an hour. So we're pretty liberal on letting people just, they can only do a small sample, but we give it out free. And a lot of the locations now are charging and you know, really making, you know, they're putting food trucks out front. And to a degree, it's a little bit of competition with the restaurants in the area, but it does create and grow the beer culture, you know. So some of the restaurants, we don't do that because we don't want to really be in competition with that side of things. But we definitely want people to come and sample the products, get a tour. And that's happening a lot. A lot of buses are coming in, and the average age is, you know, 65, 70 years old. And they're all loving the beer and buying product to go. And then we have the root beer, Captain Eli's, and people don't drink.
I love Captain Eli's.
Yeah, yeah, so that's actually, we're up like 300% on Captain Eli's, which is exciting.
I've got a big marketing idea for you.
Right? Good.
And if it's really good, you can buy lunch today because we're going to go have lunch afterwards, okay?
Yes.
Okay, here's the big idea. We've got Fred Forsley here. He is Maine's number one beer guru, president, co-founder of Shipyard Brewery. Beer tours are such a big deal. The cruise ship industry, you know, I forget how many cruise ships visit. It's starting to pick up right now. This becomes the season. Whatever it is, 20, 30 cruise ships, 10,000, 50,000 people. A buddy of mine told me years ago, I described it as kind of a scam, but I don't think that's what the intent was. But you register with these cruise companies as an expert in any field. You could be a butterfly expert. You could be an expert on Tahiti, whatever. And on all these cruises, they have 5 or 10 experts, and they pay you a little bit of money, and they give you a cruise ship cabin. And then 2 or 3 times during the cruise, they, you know, let's say I was going to be an expert on sports marketing. They would say, in Ballroom C, Steve-O Woods, expert in sports marketing, will be giving a one-hour talk on sports marketing. You find somebody that is connected to the cruise ships that make Portland a point of call, and for 1 week while the people are cruising around, you have a shipyard expert who just cruises around and gives beer seminars on boats, and then it culminates with a walking tour right from the boats down the hill up to shipyard, And then all of a sudden you go international. What do you think?
You're buying lunch. It's a great idea, but we already did it. Oh, we already did it.
Well, I'm sure you get cruise ships visiting. No.
We went on the Nova Star, they did the same. We did.
I know. But the Nova Star.
But it's a great deal.
It's not actually a cruise ship. It's the Nova Star.
We've been doing, with Amy Powers and Sandra Needham, we've been doing the Sea Trade shows in Miami, where we pitched the whole program to do that stuff. So we actually got to meet a bunch of the different cruise director people.
Like the Norwegian,
we did a cruise from Boston to Bermuda, in which we had two brewers on board, did the whole thing. But it's a great idea, but you're buying lunch.
Okay.
It is a great idea.
Well, that's why we both had it.
I don't want to hurt his feelings, but I got to tell him the truth.
I thought it was a new idea. We've got Fred Forsley here. He is the guru at Shipyard Brewing. What's the future look like in terms of brewing? Yeah, you mentioned that, everyone starts their own. Why are so many people, is the barrier of entry relatively short? Like if you get a big metal tub and you get some hops, could I be a brewer right here? It just feels like for a lot of people that love beer that they put out a shingle and go, hey, Steve-O Beer is here.
Yeah, no, the industry has all these other industries that consult to it now. And if you really want to open up a brew pub or brewery, you can hire, or your vendors are so organized. And the Brewers Association of America, which we've been a member of for years, has an annual convention in which you can go to that and literally walk around the auditorium. By the time you get done, you've touched on everybody, whether it's a canning machine, a brewing equipment, consultants that'll take you from. If you have a checkbook, you're set. You know, so if you've got a rich uncle or rich dad or family members that are willing to put up some money, or you have some money, it's not cheap. And what's amazing to me is how many people can throw $3 or $4 million into an idea and a concept, and the absorption seems to be happening pretty readily, and it's working to a lot of people.
Is it because beer consumption is going up, or is it taking out of wine, or what does the industry look at?
It's not really growing. We haven't, microbrew category has grown, but beer consumption on a total has not been dramatically growing. In fact, 5 or 10 years ago, it was going down. I think now we might be flat or up a little. But it's really coming out of the major brands, and craft is growing. So it's coming out of the big brands, and that's where it's happening. And I think, you know, some of the liquors are having that same explosion where people are doing craft vodkas and craft gins and craft whiskeys. Our population's growing, I guess, a little bit, so that may be adding to it. But I think there's going to be a saturation point in certain regions where there can only be, you know, so many. But it really depends on the model that you have. If you're going to be a brew pub, or if you're going to be a regional brewery, is very difficult to get to, because you have to, it's a substantial investment, and it's about orchestrating at all levels, and you're competing against all the big guys.
We've got Fred Forsley here, proud graduate of Chevres High School and University of New Hampshire, president and co-founder of Shipyard Brewery. Talk a little bit about here in southern Maine, here in the Portland area, there's a lot of notoriety in terms of Portland being a foodie city, and there's so many great restaurants, and Shipyard, I think, is probably in all of them. But also there's a lot of discussion about Portland being kind of a beer place, which I think has its own. So aside from just the consumption, aside from Shipyard just selling beer, what type of opportunity is there for Shipyard to play a role in attracting tourism for people that really like great food? And southern Maine is known, throughout Maine, we've got some great restaurants. But what about being known as a beer town or being a restaurant town? What do you think the economic impact is for that? And my general feeling is that it feels really positive, and other people say, let's, you know, try out different beers and go to Portland.
Yeah. You know, for every job in the brewery, there's 2.9 other jobs created in the local economy. You know, that's a known labor statistic. But we originally were some of the founding members of the Maine Brewers Trail. So back 3 or 4 years ago, we got a $10,000 grant from the state, and we set up a document that was a Maine Brewers Trail, and everybody participated as brewers and put like $1,000 up to be listed and to fund an organized marketing campaign for that. And we went in some national beer magazines as well as did a lot of PR, and we continually grow that. The Maine Brewers Guild was the other big thing. I was the president 6 years ago, and we've got a lot of energy around that. And every summer we do our own beer festival. And what it is to raise money to lobby and to make sure we have a voice in Augusta, and also focus on marketing and promoting Maine as a beer destination. And Maine beer tourism is becoming a very big part of our economic engine. 21 years ago, we started the Maine Brewers Festival. It's owned privately, but Gary's and Gritty's and about three or four others started it, and it's every November. And we did Beer Week this year in November. The first week's coming in Portland, and and what we did was we picked the slowest hotel weekend in the fall, where hotels had the most availability, and we set it for that weekend. And now it almost fills all the local hotels having the beer festival.
Well, so, and you pay one fee and you just kind of wander around,
and it brings like 1,000 people to Portland, but 1,000 people in Portland that weren't going to be there.
Yeah,
it adds up, and they go out and eat, and the beer scene and everything's going right now. We're working with the Gulf of Maine Aquarium to try to package some of the less used fish. And we're doing some unique stuff with beer batters and coming up with a fish cake and a new style with a sustainable fish that aren't readily fished. Wow. And that all came from innovation from the community trying to say, how can we deal with local chefs and how can we deal with local businesses to try to, and that'll help bring more business to the fisheries in Maine, which is obviously our foundation, historically. So in addition
to the beer, you also have Sea Dog, the restaurants, yep. The Inn at Peaks.
The Inn at Peaks had a great summer.
I know. So, you're the only guy I know that carries like 9 different cell phone iPhones. You've got 9 businesses.
Today,
I know, but every time I see you, you're juggling them. Yeah. You've got operations and distribution in Florida.
Yeah.
You're doing some things in California too?
In California, we don't have any restaurants, but we have some nice relationships, and we're growing our we have a relationship out there with Fess Parker. Remember Daniel Boone, David Crockett?
Yeah, Santa Barbara, the Fess Parker Resort out there.
Right. Ashley Parker went to Bates, and she became good friends with Bruce Forsley. We ended up representing their wines in Maine and New Hampshire,
right, yeah.
And they represent us in California. So we're doing some cross-promotional stuff. And
I can be your ambassador. I was just out in San Diego in Laguna Beach.
Definitely.
And my daughter Cammie went to school out in Santa Barbara for the last 2 years. So if you need somebody to head out and help you with this kind of stuff, we've been friends for a long time, Fred.
We can definitely do that.
I know. I give you a mug. Did you bring a case of beer today, by the way?
We can take
care of that. Do you have something hidden out in the car?
I don't.
Oh, my God.
I was running around, because as we know. But we know we can take care of that. We can make that happen.
Well, thanks so much for coming in. It's always great catching up. And I think as somebody who's from Maine and been in Maine, my feeling is not only does Shipyard make a great product, but when you see major festivals, major sporting events, major concerts, it feels like you really connect to the community and try to help out in many ways. And I wish you nothing but luck going forward.
No, same to you. It looks like you've added some new buildings outside and all that, so it's great to see both.
Well, yeah, we're both pedaling pretty hard, but it always I build a little building, you build a big brewery.
Yes.
I open up a little storage thing, and you got 10 restaurants. I don't think I'm ever going to catch up, but it's always great talking with you.
Hey, thank you.
Great having Fred Forsley, president, co-founder of Shipyard Brewery. You can find out their information at shipyard.com. They're on Instagram. They're all over the place. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Thank you for listening.